Station number 12246. Lieutenant Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 9.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 9. Did you have much Japanese air activity against you, Colonel?
The air attack on the battalion and elements of the brigade on the 31st of December 1944 was the first instance. And as I said earlier, as we marched in single file down the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the motorable track leading from the jungle-clad slopes of the Wangyo Gorge into central Burma, heading towards Yeouyou, the first large town ahead of us, we saw the six Japanese aircraft, wingtip to wingtip, coming towards us. I personally thought that there would be the RAF coming back from a strike on perhaps Japanese airfield at Shuibo, but when the left-hand port aircraft stooped on its port wing and the others followed suit, dived down towards the head of the battalion, we scattered and legged it into the jungle cover either side. It was a quick hit-and-run attack. The Japanese didn't strafe with the machine guns. They threw out, either from the cockpit or from the wings, light bombs, similar to our own 3-inch mortar bombs, aerial bombs nonetheless, anti-personnel, and there were 22 soldiers wounded and one vehicle destroyed. Captain Francis Greenwell, MC, from Lanchester, County Durham, had a very close shave when one of these bombs dropped beside him, but fortunately didn't explode. We continued marching on when the aircraft had disappeared down to the south and came across the burned out vehicle about 20 minutes, half an hour later. Also at that time we saw sitting in a jeep the two wounded chaps from the Remgen carrier of Captain Main's forward observation group, and they were very badly shaken up, and one was still shaking as if he'd got St. Vitus dance or worse. We marched past the scene of the air attack and finally settled in some fields near the village of Kaduma. The air attack was roughly in the area of Kaduma, and we pressed on from Kaduma to Tarze, where we settled down for our jungle ration lunch, and later that morning some beer came up, must have been flown forward to one of the forward landing strips which the Royal Engineers and RAF construction people prepared by bulldozing paddy fields. It was the dry season and aircraft could land and take off from these hastily constructed strips, and we got a couple of bottles of beer per man. So looking back at the previous 10 days, we'd marched best part of 100 miles and fought four actions. We had been in three of them, Sipadon, Chong, Paga Crossing and Tong Yong. I had lost two good men killed, Corporal Ted Lindsay from Mansfield, former Sherwood Forester, and Private George Hitchings from Gloucestershire, former gunner. And I recall that when we were inadvertently ambushed by the 4th, 10th Gurkha Rifles on coming out of the Sipadon Chong, I went back, was required to go back to check on whether four men lying in the chong, in the dry, sandy base, bottom of the chong, were dead or wounded or just merely lying doggo. I asked for someone to accompany me through the trestles of the bridge, and George Hitchings immediately volunteered, and a voice in the darkness said, "I'll go with you, sir." And I was very sorry to lose a man of his calibre. Private Pound had gone out, shot through the right shoulder, evacuated wounded, and safe and sound back to India. At Tarsay, we had a day's rest, and I felt rather pleased when Corporal Bobby Lowes, who had been with me in the thick of it in Tong Yong, came along and said he thought I'd done very well in action, the first time of asking. That was the 31st of December, and on that night, taking us into New Year's Day, we moved out, marching in the dark, forward towards Cabo Weir and the village of Cabo, which lie along the bank of the Mew River, which flows southwards past Yeo and eventually into the Irrawaddy. The Royal Welsh Fusiliers had captured the Cabo Weir intact, from which water was taken from the Mew River to irrigate a large part of this central Burma plains area. Marching in the darkness, I passed a signaller who had his radio tuned into the BBC London, and I was very pleased and amused to hear part of the ITMAR programme, ITMAR being the Tommy Handley It's That Man Again programme, and I deliberately walked slowly for about 10 yards to hear a few snatches of it over the airwaves. We then took up a position on the banks of the Mew River opposite Cabo and set up shop there. The following day, C Company was tasked, along with A Company, to move down the east bank of the river Mew, which was still mainly held by the Japanese, to effect a crossing of the canal just on the southern outskirts of Cabo village itself. A Company led the way and we followed about an hour behind them. On my left in the long grass I saw a group of soldiers marching the same direction as us, and just for a matter of a fleeting couple of seconds, and I thought there were number 11 platoon on my left. Later I realised that they were in fact Japanese, withdrawing southwards in the same direction as we were advancing. We took up position on a bend of the Mew River while A Company probed forward to go take and cross a footbridge just to the south of Cabo Weir. They ran into Japanese and Private Beaumont was killed and Corporal Prentice mortally wounded. But before the platoon commander tried to drag him clear, but he died in his arms. The Japanese were in considerable strength and OCA Company decided to hold where he was. Thereafter, from battalion headquarters, the colonel ordered him to pull back and take over the position on the bend in the river where we were, and then later he pulled us right back across the Mew River to where the battalion position was. Private Beaumont was buried by A Company, Major Kelly, taking a very short service under the palm trees as the sun was setting in the west. C Company, we then pulled out and walked back through the direction in which we'd come, waded the river, and the first chap I met at the battalion position was Colonel Southey, who said that A Company must have run into some very strong opposition. To us, we were withdrawing for no valid reason.
You found this frustrating under the circumstances?
Frustrating and irritating, because we just couldn't see rhyme or reason for it. We were meant to be advancing, and here we were pulling back from where we'd set off the day before, or that day. We got hold of some rice straw and lay on that, because all our ground sheets, blankets, were back at B echelon, and we took up a company position along as part of the battalion perimeter and got some snatches of sleep. Unfortunately, my batman Cyril Armitage was a most horrific snorer, and eventually I took my share of armful of straw and tossed down a few yards away, where the noise of him snoring like a large boar wasn't quite so distracting and causing loss of sleep. But of course we were still manning our sentry posts in the rifle sections, doing two on, two off. The following morning we were just having breakfast, and this would be the 2nd or 3rd of January 1945. By breakfast I mean a dollop of porridge in a mess tin, a slice of bacon, four biscuits. When to the south we heard anti-aircraft gun fire, and sure enough some anti-aircraft guns were firing at some 14 or 15 Japanese aircraft over and in the direction of Yeouyou, the first large town in the central plain. The shell bursts in the sky seemed to be a long way from the Japanese aircraft, and it crossed my mind that the shooting was poor. However, I was to learn later, when I became a low-level air defence gunner myself, or light anti-aircraft gunner as it then was called, that the self-destruct fuse of the 40mm shell explodes the shell as a safety measure when it has passed the target, if it hasn't actually hit the target and exploded. So possibly, no doubt, the gunners went closer to the Japanese aircraft than we thought. The aircraft swung northwards and came right over our battalion position. They were weaving amongst themselves in the sky. I wouldn't like to estimate the height. Height estimation is a very difficult thing. But suffice to say, the rising suns on the wings of the aircraft that came closest to us were as plain as a newspaper. Had the pilot had his hood back, no doubt we could have seen him as well. They crossed over us weaving, everyone froze. I just looked up surreptitiously. I was under a bush or a low tree, and with everybody freezing and no one firing, the Japanese pilots didn't see us. They moved away over to the east, where 19th Indian Division were advancing on our left and in front of us, driving down towards the west bank of the Irrawaddy to the east of Shwebo. They weaved around there for some 5 or 10 minutes, didn't come down to attack any targets, and eventually went off to the south in the direction of Mandalay and the Irrawaddy River. 2 days later on the sitrep, we saw where they'd all been shot down at Maketilla. I wondered at the time whether this was correct or whether it was propaganda. But many years later, when I was station adjutant at RAF Leconfield, the late group captain, R.N.H. Buck Courtney, he told me that he had been wing commander operations that day at Imphal. They knew that these Japanese aircraft had come from one of the airstrips at Maketilla in central Burma, their main central Burma base, and the RAF bounced them on the way back when they were low on fuel and shot the lot down.
Is an air attack particularly frightening for an infantryman?
Well, we only had that small taste of the six, but many things are pretty shattering in war, and we were fortunate only to get that one small taste on the 31st of December. And I should imagine that in France, particularly in 1940, Dunkirk, and in the Western Desert, when we were on the losing side, that it was pretty shattering and horrific. After the aircraft had disappeared, that day we again crossed by wading the Mew River and moved down to where we had been previously. Passed through A Company, and I was ordered by Major Shuttle to take a patrol to see if the footbridge was still held by the Japanese where A Company had got held up 2 days previously. I noticed civilians with bullock carts and bicycles using the road parallel to the Cabo Canal normally, and no sign of any enemy. We then moved forward and found that the bridge was clear, and I looked after the west bank and another platoon, the east bank, and company headquarters, and the third platoon close behind me, and my number 10 platoon. We found the body of Corporal Prentice and buried it there on the side of the canal. Later that morning, two of the platoon on the east bank who'd been over to liaise with my chaps were on their way back when suddenly they dropped flat on the footbridge and looked up to the north on the east bank. I looked in the direction that they were looking and saw a Japanese soldier crawling towards a tree and getting into a firing position. Private Corderwood on my left fired at him, but as he had the EY rifle discharge cup on the muzzle of the rifle, he couldn't aim correctly. I saw his bullet strike way low on the back side of the east bank of the canal. I had a bash at him and missed. I then was quite certain he was aiming dead in line with me. I ducked down, reloaded, looked up again, and he was then running away. I fired again, but must have aimed off too much because he didn't fall. He had left behind his pack, and inside was a Japanese flag and various items of personal kit. He'd be a straggler making his way south. The following day, we moved on down the bank of the canal to Yeouyou town, which we skirted on the normal dusty track, crossed the Bailey Bridge and moved eastwards into a banana grove. The battalion spread out round in the paddy fields around this banana grove, and we had a couple of days there. That first evening, the major held his own group and said that the colonel, Cyril Southey, was probably coming to see us as he was leaving the battalion. However, he didn't, and it was quite obvious that he'd got the order of the boot after the three actions that we had lost. However, that evening, my 6 months was up as a second lieutenant, and I was told to put up another star with indelible pencil on my shirt epaulettes as a full lieutenant.
Can I just ask you the name of the river that you had just crossed over?
Mew. M-U.
What was the terrain like that you're now marching through and fighting through, Colonel?
All flat. And we were now to be mainly concerned from now on with villages and any high ground, checking that out and clearing that out. But the Japs had pulled right back, falling back towards the Irrawaddy River, so we were merely sweeping them up as we went. And behind us we had the Indian Army 268 Infantry Brigade clearing up behind us. So as we advanced through central Burma, the 33rd Corps, 19th Indian Division was on our left under Major General Rees. We were under command of Major General Cameron Nicholson, and on our right was the 20th Indian Division, commanded by Major General Douglas Gracie. And the plan was for 19th Indian Division to cross the Irrawaddy east of Schwebo and north of Mandalay, one of their bridgeheads being well to the north of Mandalay, northeast of Schwebo at Thabakin. The 20th Indian Division coming down the line of the Chinwin River through largest towns like Budalin, similar size to Yeou. When I say towns, most of the buildings were in fact made of wood because of the abundance of teak in the Burma forests, and then sweeping down through Monowa and across the Irrawaddy River on our left. And we were ultimately in February to force the central bridgehead over the Irrawaddy at Nagazun. I'll come to that later. We then moved forward from the banana grove east of Yeou, past the large town of Schwebo, which was more or less the political capital of the central Burma plain. And we then moved to a small village where six tracks cross Haladaw, Haladaw. The battalion, less our own C company, were in the main village, whereas we were just across the road in a Buddhist monastery area. And Buddhist monasteries are called Punji Chong. A Buddhist preach is a Chungi, a Punji, and a Punji Chong is the monastery. At that village, we had a welcome visit by an ENSA group containing the well-known stage screen stars Forsyth, Seaman and Farrell, and a beautiful English soprano singer who had adopted the famous stage name of Cherry Lind. They put on a very good show for us one evening, with a stage illuminated by Jeep headlights, and the Burmese villagers themselves sat at the back, cross-legged, behind our troops, thoroughly enjoying it themselves. And it was quite a memorable experience to hear Cherry Lind sing the Ave Maria and the 19th Indian Division guns banging away in one of their bridgeheads over the Irrawaddy to the east of us.
Were you getting any contact or much contact with Burmese civilians? And what was happening to them for so far as the Japanese are concerned?
They had initially in 1942 been pro-Jap, 90% of them, but they'd had enough of them. And occasionally we came across leaflets that we had, a British aircraft had dropped two in Burmese to the Burmans, pointing out that the Japanese were withdrawing back to the Irrawaddy to drown in the river and to come over to our side. They rarely appeared to be sitting on the fence. When we took patrols out, I took a patrol out to the east to a village with two Anglo-Burman interpreters from the intelligence section, and they laid on quite a good meal for us with rice and that, which we very much appreciated, although it took some 2 hours to prepare, but it was well worth waiting for. Also while at Haladaw, in a field that was very soft soil, which had grown tomatoes, we held a very amusing mule gymkhana with six or seven races between our own mules within the battalion, the mule company, and neighbouring units, Royal Berkshire's and Royal Welsh Fusiliers mules. I got some of my chaps, Private Husband and Private Davis, to ride. I rode myself, Captain Greenwell and his Batman Hayes, they rode. And in the practice, it was quite amusing to see Davis bail out backwards off the back of one of these mules. I just forget who won the relay race, which company won it, but I know that one mule bolted and was never seen again, having shed its rider. There was a tote operating, and when it came to one particular race, I spoke to the mule sergeant, Sergeant Branch, who gave me a red-hot tip. I gave him 10 rials to put, I beg your pardon, 10 rupees to put on for me, and Spooner came in at a good price, and the winnings kept me in Nestle's milk for time to come, because whilst looking at the I section's map board one evening, Private Bailey, military medal, came up to him and said he was going on leave to Calcutta, being flown out. Was there anything I wanted? So I gave him 20 rupees or thereabouts and said, will you send me some Nestle's milk? And dutifully he did. And I got about three or four tins of his Nestle's milk. It was an absolute godsend when we got it on the 2 or 3 weeks later on the far bank of the Irrawaddy.
Were there no other additional food supplies coming through other than your rations?
Just our rations. Mail, again, came through quite well, albeit in fits and starts, but we certainly got letters from home. Whether it was weekly or fortnightly, it was always a godsend, and our lads, whenever we could, got a letter off back home themselves. From Hallador, we went forward eventually in the first week of February, southwards towards Sagang, and debussed at Nat Ki Yang, where brigade headquarters was set up. And C Company, along with the brigade headquarters defence platoon, covered the brigade headquarters at Nat Ki Yang, and the battalion, less C Company, moved further on to the village of Ngatayor, not far from the north bank of the Irrawaddy itself. Where the motorable road ended was the village of Yawathitjean, which had been captured by the Royal Scots of 4th Brigade, and the Royal Berkshires moved in. The Royal Berkshires moved in there. From Nat Ki Yang to Ngatayor was approximately 3 miles, and most mornings my platoon were detailed off to open the road, as we call it, or open the track between the Nat Ki Yang and the battalion, because each night the Japanese sent patrols across to harass the battalion. It was also shelled quite regularly from the south bank by Japanese artillery. The Burmese villagers, some of them have a toilet which is shaped rather like a sentry box, but it's on wheels like the old-fashioned hen house. And obviously they fill one hole and then cover it up and move it on a few yards to a new hole. And D Company, who are on the south side, the receiving end of the village, where most of the Jap shells landed, but fortunately didn't kill anyone because they got dug in and roofed very, very smartly. And the secret of digging in Burma was first stop Australia, get down, dig or die, as in the Western Desert. When one of these large shells came trundling across, they looked up after the bang and saw that one of these Burmese bogs had disintegrated. My patrol used to, platoon strength patrol, would either go down the railway line side, the railway line was deserted of course, and in the nearest railway siding, just a mile out in Ngatayor, was a wrecked engine which the RAF bow fighters had peppered very, very severely, knocking it out. And we'd also open the track to make sure there were no nips around. On one Japanese sortie against the battalion, Corporal Jimmy Schrapel of D Company was having a quick nap before it was his turn to be on sentry duty, which we call being on stag, when he dreamt some Japs were approaching. Actually, it could have been subconscious mind, because a Japanese patrol was actually coming through the bushes on the edge of the village as he awoke. He opened fire with his Sten gun, and three Japs dropped. One of them was still wriggling, so he snatched the rifle from a gobsmacked, thunderstruck sentry and put the Japanese firmly back to his makers. When daylight came, The bodies were examined. One was the body of an officer, Second Lieutenant Yahashi, of 124 Infantry Regiment of the Japanese Division, facing us, which would be either the 15th or the 31st, but definitely identified as Second Lieutenant Yahashi of 124 Infantry Regiment. Corporal Schrapel later presented that sword to the Durham Light Infantry Museum, where it is now at Akeley Heads in Durham. But a very good effort to get three with the one burst.
You mentioned their subconscious. Wait a minute. Take over at times when you're in these situations.
I think various individuals might well have experienced that, but Schrapel said that he appeared to dream that some Japs were approaching the village. But whether it was mental telepathy or what, I wouldn't know. But various people in all three services have had some very, very amazing experiences.